in the limelight.
In Britain, almost two-fifths of children in northeast England live in poverty after a decade of decline, as campaigners warn of worse to come. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's social policy editor, Patrick Butler. The piece is titled, Northeast England Overtakes London as UK's Child Poverty Hotspot. East of England has the highest rate of child poverty of anywhere in the United Kingdom, for the first time overtaking London as the nation's hotspot for hardship and deprivation, new analysis has shown. Although the latest UK-wide figures show child poverty rates overall fell slightly in the first year of the pandemic due to the temporary £20 weekly uplift to universal credit, detailed breakdown shows child poverty continued to rise in areas of northeast England like Sunderland, Newcastle, and Middlesbrough. End Child Poverty, a coalition of poverty charities that published the analysis, called for a new national poverty strategy, warning that Britain's child poverty rates were on the edge of a precipice and will rise sharply as a result of the removal of the £20 uplift to universal credit last October. Although the government's cost of living support package announced one-off payments of at least £1,200 to low-income families this year, the coalition believes these temporary measures will only partly remedy dramatic increases in energy bills and in food prices. The first tranche of a £650 payment to low-income families in receipt of universal credit, job seekers' allowance and other benefits is due to be paid over a two-week period starting from Thursday. Energy prices are expected to soar in the autumn, with a price cap on track to rise to £3,244 a year in October and to £3,363 a year in January. The current cap, already at record level, is at £1,971. Child poverty rates also rose in Wales, up to 34% in 2020-2021, compared with 31% the year before the pandemic. This compared with the average in England of 29%, that is 30% in 2020-2021, and poverty rates of 21% in Scotland and 24% in Northern Ireland. The average for United Kingdom was 27%. The increase in child poverty rates in the northeast of England and in Wales was attributed partly to the higher numbers of households receiving benefits under the old legacy system rather than universal credit. These households were excluded from the £20 uplift to universal credit. Rather than being levelled up, it's clear that inequalities for children and young people across the northeast of England are widening even further, and this must surely act as a serious wake-up call for both the current and incoming government about the scale and urgency of the child poverty crisis that we face, said Anna Turley, the chair of the North East Poverty Commission. The northeast of England has seen a precipitous shift in child poverty in recent years. In 2014, rates were at 26%, the joint second lowest in England. The most recent figures show 38% of children in northeast of England lived below the poverty line during 2020-2021, up from 37% the previous year. The 11 local authority areas in the United Kingdom with the biggest rises in child poverty over the last 6 years were all from the northeast of England, with Newcastle-upon-Tyne, Redcar and Cleveland, Gateshead and Middlesbrough recording significant increases in child poverty. At least 40% of children are growing up poor in a third of the region's parliamentary constituencies, including Red Wall constituencies that voted Conservative in the 2019 general election. Redcar with 41% and Bishop Auckland with 40%. Nationally, the highest rates of poverty continue to be in big cities, with Tower Hamlets in London continuing to record the highest rate of child poverty in the United Kingdom at over 51% in 2020-2021, down from 56% in 2019-2020. The parliamentary seat with the highest child poverty rate is Bethnal Green and Bow in East London, with 56%. Last week, a cross-party coalition on poverty was established, chaired by the Tory peer, Lady Stroud, who said a new plan was needed as the poverty levels of this country are too high and the government doesn't have a strategic approach to tackling the problem of poverty. The Shadow Welfare Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, said, "As the cost of living crisis becomes more painful, the desperation facing families is set to worsen. But instead of offering solutions, a parade of Conservative leadership candidates are promising billions in unfunded tax cuts that risk deep, swingeing cuts to universal credit, pushing even more children into poverty." A government spokesperson said, "The latest figures show there were 500,000 fewer children in absolute poverty after housing costs than in 2009-2010. But we recognise people are struggling with rising prices, which is why we are protecting the 8 million most vulnerable families with at least £1,200 of direct payments, starting this week. Through our £37 billion support package, we are saving the typical employee over £330 a year through a tax cut this month, allowing people on universal credit to keep £1,000 more of what they earn. And in April, we significantly increased the national living wage to £9.50, the largest ever rise."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the Newsline.
President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not, and they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the U.S. president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh help promote the U.S.'s foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the U.S. president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the U.S.'s ironical foreign policy. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the sought deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the U.S. helped end the 2021 war on Gaza but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the U.S.'s $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the U.S.'s stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it. And we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that, but it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda. Uh, after spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity. Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline, and he turned the United States from an oil-exporting country into an oil-importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the forced Geneva Convention, and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks. saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی، ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاده خواهانه ای نداریم، هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم. مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است.
Amir Abdullahian's remarks came in response to U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley, who claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, a plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists say carbon capture is hard and expensive, and focus must be on reducing carbon emissions. We now present you an article written by Helena Horton. The piece is titled Greenhouse Gas Removal Not a Silver Bullet to Achieve Net Zero. Many of Britain's top scientists working on carbon capture technologies do not believe they will be developed and scaled up in time to reach net zero and limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Experts speaking at a greenhouse gas removal hub event in London warned that these techniques, including direct air capture, biofuels, biochar, afforestation, and advanced weathering, are not a silver bullet and should make up just a fraction of the effort to decarbonize. The researchers were polled by event organizers on whether they believed the carbon removal targets would be met. Of the 114 scientists in the audience, 57% said they were not confident that Britain would meet the 2030 goals in the net zero strategy of 5 million tons of engineered greenhouse gas removal and 30,000 hectares a year of tree planting. 25% said they were quite confident, and 11% said there was no chance. The scientists are taking part in a £70 million government-funded competition to find the best ways to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. These technologies are due to begin removing vast amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere by 2030, with the hope of being that the winning methods could be scaled up and ready for market in 2 years' time. The government appears on the whole to be confident that carbon capture methods will be developed fairly rapidly. For example, the Department for Transport has stated that greenhouse gas removal technologies will enable Britons to take guilt-free flights by the end of next year. But those involved in the programme were less optimistic. But when shown a press release from the British government declaring that these technologies will enable net zero flights by 2023, Professor Mark Taylor, the Deputy Director of Energy Innovation at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, seems sceptical. He told The Guardian, "No, that's not the case. We've got to get people to believe this can work, but maybe that claim is a little bit cheeky." Gideon Henderson, the chief scientist at the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, said, "Greenhouse gas removal technologies is hard and expensive, and we cannot afford to see it as a surrogate to compensate for continued emissions in sectors that can be decarbonized. It is not an excuse not to decarbonize, so we must drive down emissions anyway." By far the most popular technology based on applications to the program was direct air capture. This process involves removing carbon dioxide from the air, usually using giant fans and heating it to a very high temperature. This carbon can then be stored in geological formations or combined with hydrogen to create synthetic fuels. While ministers like this idea, those leading the program believe it may not be the answer, due to the energy intensity required and how expensive it is. Professor Taylor said, "People see it as having the biggest market. There's been funding from American companies. It feels like a silver bullet. There are lots of people who like it. Ministers like it because they think, oh, that sounds easy. You can take it out of the air and that's it. And that's the thing that gets investment." Professor Taylor added, "I'm very much on the fence as to whether it is the best solution. It is very, very expensive, so some of the other technologies may emerge as winners. But the good thing about our competition is we pick the best one." The Guardian approached the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy for comment. Greenhouse gas removal methods being trialled with UK funding include afforestation. Henderson said this is the poster child of greenhouse gas removal technologies because everyone seems to love it and it's nice to have more trees. However, he said trees are not a panacea because of the amount of land they need, which is taken out of food production, which then causes tensions with food security. There is also a tension between woodland, which has more biodiversity benefits but is slower growing, and forests, which grow quickly and lock in more carbon sooner. Also, storing in soil. While sorting carbon in soil is a popular method, according to Henderson, there are concerns over how long the carbon can be stored in the soil and how it is measured. If the soil begins to release carbon again shortly after it is stored, this could cause problems, especially if it is not being measured effectively and counted in net zero targets. He explained, "I think that if we see significant financial resources coming into this area to incentivize storing soil carbon without being able to measure it and being sure of its permanence, there is a risk of continued emissions from storage, which isn't permanent or sufficiently well measured. Also, there is advanced weathering, dropping tiny rock particles into the sea in order to cause chemical reactions that lock carbon in the ocean is potentially a very exciting technology, but it is in an earlier stage than many of the other carbon capture methods. It has interesting potential as the ocean stores carbon in higher concentrations than in air. There is even hope that it could help to reverse ocean acidification. However, there are also concerns that the process could upset the delicate balance of the oceans." Direct air capture. The idea of a machine that can suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and stick it permanently in rocks is a very attractive one, and it is perhaps unsurprising that this is the most popular technology for scientists trying to solve this problem. "But it is currently a very energy-intensive process," Professor Taylor explained. "We need to use energy to extract the carbon dioxide, the pure stream carbon dioxide from the solid, so that we're looking for an integration that can drive down the costs of direct air capture, and particularly drive down the cost of extracting the carbon dioxide and the energy cost of extracting the CO2. Because at the moment, there's no point in capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then using natural gas to run a heat process to extract a pure CO2 stream. Biofuels. While Henderson pointed out that this is a carbon storage that is already happening at some scale in the United Kingdom and could be a really potent form of greenhouse gas removal, there are concerns over biodiversity and pressure on land use. This is because growing the crops often creates a monoculture, and this land is taken out of production for food. Biochar. Biochar is a stable, long-lived, charcoal-like product produced from heating biomass in the absence of oxygen. It is a carbon-rich and can be applied to land to sequester carbon dioxide in soils for an extended period of time. This could be relatively easy and cheap, but there are concerns as to how long the carbon would be stored in the soil and whether it would have any negative impacts on the soil.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Today, too, the calculations to pit the people against the Islamic Republic is wrong. They think that they can put an element in the way of the Islamic Republic, one that they know the Islamic Republic cares about very much, the people. But this is wrong. Why do the Americans make this mistake? Because they have counselors who are treasonous Iranian. They give them counsel. The treasonous counselors betray both their country and them as well. Why? Because they give them counsel without having correct information. And those poor creatures act according to their advice and they fail. One of their counsels is this: you can count on the Iranian people for confronting the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. But the Iranian people have become tired of religion, the Islamic government and the clergy. You can count on them and they will stand up to the Islamic government.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These ill-advised traitors for both sides, counselors, say this to their American masters. They give them money and receive such analysis from them. They repeat this in their speeches, in their Senate and other places. Inside the country too, some naive individuals, of course, they are fortunately small in number, believe in them. Sometimes I hear them say online and newspapers that the people have lost their belief in the clergy and religion. We have such viewpoints inside the country too. Well, this is one of the 100% wrong calculations. Today, the people are surely interested in the revolution and religion more than they were in the first day of the revolution. If someone wants to understand the people's orientation towards the revolution, revolutionary activities and jihad, they must look at the burial ceremony of Shahid Qasim Soleimani with millions of participants in it. The dismembered body of Shahid Soleimani was bid farewell by millions of people. The people commemorated and respected a revolutionary and mujahid person who had laid down his life for the Islamic Republic like that.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. lawmakers will rubber stamp a bill authorizing tens of billions more to the Defense Department that it didn't even ask for. Stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Ben Freeman and Faizeh Fatizadeh writers. This article is published under the heading Congress Showers the Pentagon with Cash While Americans Pinch Pennies. Stay tuned for more. Gas prices are at an all-time high in the U.S. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months in the U.S. There are growing fears that the U.S. economy is poised to fall into recession. What is Congress doing as a growing chorus of Americans think these and other economic issues are the most important problems facing the U.S. today? They're planning to give military contractors the biggest payday they have ever seen. This week, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending, not to the American people, but to the Pentagon. As happens nearly every year, more than half of this sum will likely go to Pentagon contractors, whose CEOs make tens of millions of dollars while telling their shareholders that war and rising global tensions are good for business. Yet Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than the military even asked for. Instead of funding projects across the country such as the littoral combat ship known in U.S. Navy circles as the Little Crappy Ship that reportedly can travel half its maximum speed without cracking its hull, Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by $37 billion or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering the taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. In addition to the economic cost of funneling ever more money into the Pentagon, contractors that win the lion's share of the Pentagon pie have left less and less money for the actual members of the U.S. military. U.S. troops and their families are now facing the same problems of the affordable housing and inflation that plague the rest of the U.S., all while doing their part to defend the country. Teva Jebreler, commentator, documented in Responsible Statecraft last month, increases in rents and inflation have forced many military families in the U.S. to move further and further away from bases and in some cases to live paycheck to paycheck. with military families and other hardworking Americans struggling to make ends meet, why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received? In short, Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They have spread their influence and money around to lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that a rising defense budget lifts all boats inside the Beltway. The defense sector is also one of the top spenders on campaign contributions to members of Congress, particularly to those lawmakers with the greatest sway over the defense budget. In fact, members of the House Armed Services Committee, who last month approved the defense bill the House will vote, have already received more than $3.25 million in campaign contributions from defense contractors in just the current election cycle, according to campaign finance data compiled by Open Secrets. Pentagon contractors also spend more than $100 million on lobbying every year and currently have 652 lobbyists working for them, more than double the 307 lobbyists working for labor groups, for example. That comes to one lobbyist for every elected representative and senator, with more than 100 lobbyists to spare. More than two-thirds of these lobbyists are actually former government employees, including high-ranking congressional staff like Speaker Nancy Pelosi's former chief of staff, who went on to become a lobbyist for BAE Systems. Pentagon contractors also seek out former members of Congress themselves, for example, 5 weeks after Howard Bach McKinn, who chaired the House Armed Services Committee until his retirement from Congress in early 2015, he began representing a defense contractor that employed his services as a principal in the newly formed McKinn Group. Last but certainly not least, defense contractors give tens of millions of dollars to the U.S. top think tanks every year. Scholars at these same think tanks with defense industry ties often write articles and appear in the media promoting ever higher levels of defense spending. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. Worse yet, Congress is adding tens of billions of dollars that the military didn't even ask for, on top of what was already a record-setting budget request that is more than the defense budgets of the next 9 highest-spending countries combined. While much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut down. They're soon arrested by Scottish police, but they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realized that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change, and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALS made 8.3 billion euros in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians. It was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine Action say, they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it, until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Puriza, London.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a two-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements